This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Just to say that for rights reasons, the music in the original radio broadcast has been removed for this podcast. Welcome to Weekend Woman's Hour with me, Anita Rani. On today's programme, a sprinkling of stardust. Daisy Edgar-Jones telling us about her new role on stage as Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and her friendship with Paul Mescal. The actor Anne-Marie Duff on her latest role in the play Little Foxes, set in Alabama at the turn of the 20th century, about a dysfunctional family. And comedian Sophie Duker on her new stand-up show and on going into therapy with her dad.
I don't know if I would recommend it. If you're scared about asking your friends about your vibe, going to therapy with your dad is a whole roller coaster.
And he was up for it?
He was up for it, yeah. I think there comes a time when you are an adult and your parents are also adults, when you're like, huh, you're a full person. You've got flaws. I gotta kind of reevaluate my opinion of you. So I think it was a really cool, nuts thing to do with my dad, but ultimately a lot of material.
Also, the first ever stage adaptation of Ballet Shoes, Noel Stretfield's 1936 novel. Director Katie Rudd and star Pearl Mackey tell us all about it. And a look at why black female journalists are supposedly leaving the profession. So lots to get through. Grab a cup of whatever takes your fancy and settle in for the hour. But first, it's the rape trial that has shocked the world, and Gisèle Pellico is the woman at the centre of it. At the very beginning of this trial, Gisèle waived her right to anonymity, saying she wanted the shame to change sides. The shame is not hers. It belongs to the 51 men who have now been convicted of violating her, the ordinary, everyday men, including her husband, who orchestrated the horrific 10-year ordeal. Let's hear a clip of Gisèle's statement she gave outside court in Avignon on Thursday.
Je n'ai jamais regretté cette décision.
I have never regretted this decision. I have confidence now in our capacity, collectively, to find a better future in which men and women alike can live harmoniously together, with respect and mutual understanding.
Gisèle Pellico went on to say that this trial was a very difficult ordeal. I think first of all of my three children, David, Caroline and Florian. I also think of my grandchildren because they are the future and it is also for them that I have led this fight, as well as my daughters-in-law, Aurore and Celine. I also think of all the other families affected by this tragedy. Well, yesterday I was joined by the BBC correspondent Andrew Harding, who's been reporting on this case, and by Cynthia Alouz, journalist and academic and founder of the Women's Voices. I started by asking Andrew how the sentences of these men for a variety of offences have been received by the wider public.
I think the judges were pretty much following the guidelines. There was frustration outside the court at some of those sentences, particularly when some of the men were actually set free, and one of them I saw walking through the crowd and almost having to be rescued by the police because there was so much anger that any of these men could be allowed out. But there is a general respect here for the system of justice, for the rule of law, and I think most French people, and frankly most of the accused lawyers were saying, you know, they didn't get exactly what the prosecution had asked for. In generally, they got slightly less, but, you know, those are pretty much the rules, and I think most of France will accept them and move on.
Lots of dark and chilling details about this case coming out, and including that his depravity extended, this Dominique Pellico's, beyond his wife and his daughter. Caroline Dorion was heard shouting in court, "I'll never see you again, you'll die alone like a dog."
Yes, so there were two photos found on that huge cache of videos and photos in Dominique Pellico's home. Two of them were of Caroline lying in a bed with underwear on that were not her own. She was in a strange position. She is convinced that she was drugged and raped by her father. Her father, who, remember, has denied absolutely everything until the proof was incontrovertible, has insisted he did not rape his daughter. But there are clearly grounds to suspect him of that. Many people have expressed deep sympathy for Caroline because she is in this hell now. At least her mother has proof of what happened to her. But Caroline is in this dreadful situation where she does not know, and perhaps will never know, what her father did to her. And so she's become quite an active campaigner on the issue of drug-facilitated rape. And you can see her anguish and her anger in court. And you can also see, frankly, the trauma within the family. I think there are divisions and tensions, as you can expect in any family that's been through such agonies.
And there are other potential cases that Dominique Pellicot has been alleged to have been involved with that are now getting more attention. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, we interviewed the psychiatrist who'd assessed Pellicot, and he made it very clear that you don't just suddenly start drugging and raping your wife in retirement, and that there was clearly a build-up to this that could have been going on for many, many years. And we now have DNA evidence confirming that in 1999, Dominique Pellicot assaulted a young woman in Paris. There was a drop of blood found at the scene, and that has now been linked to him. He's admitted to assaulting her, but not to attempted rape. But she says it was an attempted rape. And now there is a cold case that's being reopened from 1991 of another woman, almost identical circumstances, a young estate agent. She was raped and murdered. And the strong suspicion is that this was one of Dominique Pellicot's earlier crimes, even though he has again denied that.
Andrew, if you could just stay right there for a moment. I'm also joined this morning by Cynthia Alouz, who's a journalist and academic and founder of the Women's Voices. Cynthia, you were in court yesterday. Do you see this as a pivotal moment or a watershed moment for feminism in France?
I was inside the court, but outside there were feminist groups. I see them shout, and I know that what is frustrating that the men receive less severe sentences that asked by the prosecution. But in the other end, when I discussed with the lawyers yesterday, they were saying that the sentences are more important due to the public eye and the feminist movement. So yes, I really think that it will be setting a precedent for future cases.
We're getting messages from our listeners this morning reflecting on what's happening. I'm just going to read a couple out, and it'd be interesting to know the sorts of conversations that are happening amongst women in France. Becca in Cambridge has said, "I'm in total awe of Gisèle Pellicot's awe-inspiring bravery to put her head above the parapet and call out this horrific behaviour, not just for herself, but for the bigger picture of female victims of rape and other non-consensual attacks is so inspiring and humbling. I will aim to take some of her sheer grace into the rest of my day. May she live with a sense of peace and safety for the rest of her days." What are the conversations taking place amongst people outside the court and more generally in France?
Yes, you know, everyone seeing Gisèle Pellicot as really a feminist icon. Yesterday, everyone put me messages on social media to thank her, for her courage, because she went into the public eyes sharing her story, but also sharing disturbing images and the detail of the terrific, the horrible act that she been through. She really bring the topic in the forefront of the news, raising awareness about sexual violence and how to fight violence against women. So every woman here in France really want to thank her. And I think she, you know, having for now an iconic feminist is very important, because most of the cases, there is no proof. And here, this is a quite historic case with so many proof, more than 20,000 proof videos, pictures and messages. So for the first time, also, we have the men involved. They're not discussing if the act happened or not because of those proof. So I'm pretty sure that almost all family in France discuss this case. So it's raising really a concern about sexual violence. Even Emmanuel Macron tweeted this morning.
And lots of conversations taking place, particularly amongst feminists, about the sentencing. But also campaigners said that this case proved the need for consent to be built into France's rape laws, as in other European countries. What do you think about that?
I'm not so sure I discuss with both sides. I'm not a lawyer. Obviously, what we want is to protect more the victim. You know, during this trial, a lot of men tried to explain that did not intend to rape. When we discuss this topic, lawyers or even feminists are not really agree about how to do so, because we have a strict law about rape here. And we don't want to diminish the protection regarding women. So it's a really an ongoing topic, and we'll have to be very careful if we are modifying the law in the future.
Do you think, you said that Macron has spoken out about it on a political level, that do you think change is coming?
You know, I hope so. You know, in every crisis, women are not really present, whether it's political or economical things. We change many times of government every time this is a topic, saying that women are not really present into the discussion. Here, Emmanuel Macron, you know, he said he wanted to put gender equality as a pivotal topic of his term, but a lot of feminist organizations are asking for much more money and also a full minister for those questions. So we have a lot to do. It's very important that all men, politics, and all the population are really motivate to change this, because otherwise we continuing having those kind of cases.
Thank you, Cynthia. Andrew, outside of court yesterday, when Gisèle Pelicot made her statement, she also thanked all the people who supported her, the lawyers and the journalists who covered the case. She's been dignified and generous throughout this trial. You've been covering it for months. What's the impact been on you?
Well, I think for anybody who sat in that courtroom and watched those graphic videos, they're something that cannot be forgotten, that the sights and the sounds were extraordinary. But what I think I've taken from this case is something very positive, that actually, as a journalist, you know, often you explore these very grim stories and you feel the need to tell people about them and inform people, but without any great sense that you're part of some bigger process. And yet in this case, I think the act of doing what Gisèle Pelicot wanted, which is to spread this message and to expose what happened there, feels like being part of something incredibly important, that, you know, that this is a case that really can change society, and that we play a role in that. And I think that for a lot of us who've sat through so much of this trial, that has felt very inspiring and very motivating.
Andrew Harding, BBC correspondent, and journalist Cynthia Alouz there. And if you have been affected by any of the issues discussed in this conversation, you can find support on the BBC Action Line website. Now, Nuala was joined this week by the actor Anne-Marie Duff, playing to rave reviews for her latest role at the Young Vic in London in The Little Foxes. You may also currently be watching her in Bad Sisters, where Anne-Marie plays Grace, who is controlled by her abusive husband, a performance that she won a BAFTA for. Or you might have been a fan of her as Fiona in Shameless 2 decades ago. But first, The Little Foxes. A 1939 play by Lillian Hellman explores a family's desire for wealth and influence, and also the power struggle between the siblings. It's set in Alabama at the turn of the 20th century, where the dysfunctional Hubbard family are plotting to do a business deal that will bring them yet more money and power. Anne-Marie plays Regina Hubbard, an ambitious woman whose desires are thwarted by her position in the family and society. But Nuala began by asking Anne-Marie about that breakthrough role in Shameless.
You know, I get recognised more still for Shameless than anything.
Isn't that something?
I'm clinging on to the notion that I look the same.
What was it about Fiona in Shameless that captured the imagination? Maybe you could tell people just a line on who she was.
Oh, yeah. So Shameless was about this bonkers family, but we all lived in an estate in Manchester, and it was a sort of dramedy, if you like, written by Paul Abbott, and he used to create these extraordinary female characters. So although she was this young working class girl. She was also a sort of mother figure and a bit wild, but at the same time holding everyone together. So she had lots of different energies. So I think that's partly it too, you know.
Well, you know, there's many more roles, I have to say, that people must be stopping you in the street for as well. But I want to start specifically with The Little Foxes. Yeah. I went to see it last Monday. I loved it. This is a play from 1939, written by Lillian Hellman, which I thought was so interesting as well, having a female writer at that time.
Yeah, and I don't think there's been a production of this play in London for about 20 years. It's a massive classic in America. So it's performed quite regularly in America, but not so much here.
Brings us to the southern states and, shall we say, could have even been seen as an original script for Succession.
Succession, exactly.
Right,
yeah.
This family's desire for wealth and influence and this power struggle between siblings. But let us talk about Regina Hubbard, this ambitious woman that's at the centre of this family. I mean, we love her, we hate her while we're watching her. Yeah. How do you feel about her? How did you decide to play her?
Well, that was the quest for the kingdom for me, really. You know, I had to sell the notion of this woman who was completely thwarted and therefore driven to all sorts of unhealthy behaviour.
So she has two brothers that are trying to basically do a power and money grab.
That's why it's very Succession-y. It's about this family. And, you know, it was written in the 30s, but actually set 1890.
Yes.
So not terribly long after the American Civil War and the abolition of slavery. So you have this whole swathe of people who are desperately trying to cling on to the wealth because they've lost their main source of income. And, you know, so that by fair means or foul, they need to hang on to their power and resources. And so they're behaving despicably. And so what happens is that you get panic and fear and everybody's standing on each other to try and achieve what they want. And inside of that, then you have the gender politics of, you know, a woman being used and cheated and then having to try and come back from that. And the only way that she can do that is a pretty desperate way. And so that's kind of what the play is about, really, I guess.
You've also said that there's not enough female Machiavellis. Tell me a little bit more about this. So we have the role of Regina, but do you still feel that way about roles in general?
I just think we want more of everything inside female roles, don't we? We're all swollen with every season. You know, there's nobody who's just one thing. And quite often, not always, but quite often, a female character can be there to represent a certain energy or a certain character quality. Sharon Horgan went completely against that in Bad Sisters and created all these women who are full of everything, which is very tasty. But yeah, quite often you're there to serve some sort of piece of a jigsaw rather than being an integral part of the momentum of a story.
But you bring up Bad Sisters. For anybody who hasn't watched it, why haven't you watched it? Amory plays Grace. It's a black comedy, these five sisters, the Garvey sisters, and there's sibling rivalry there, I guess, as well. Is there something about family dynamics that particularly attracts you?
I just think they make for great stories, whether it's King Lear or Bad Sisters, you know, because families are an enforced... What would you say?
Network.
Network, yeah, yes. Yeah, enforced chemical reaction, you
yes.
know? And also, it's that you have no choice but to deal with each other or walk away. Mm. And that's the gamble, isn't it? And that's the sacrifice. But there's still this magnetic draw.
Yes. And I'm coming back to Bad Sisters. I'm thinking about the four sisters that kind of rally around Grace because she's in this controlling relationship with the husband, that there's no love lost between him and the rest of the sisters. And they kind of try to protect her. But it is a very beautiful representation that you create of Grace, of this woman and what she's going through. And I'm thinking people must come up to you about Grace as well now.
Yeah, lots of people talk to me about coercion and also the idea of it being displayed in a very middle class, very nice lifestyle version. I think quite often the iconography around abuse can be sort of very specific and, oh, it's alcohol fueled or it's to do with a lack of resources or it's to do. And, you know, it's not. It lives in every corner of every version of a living room. And so, yeah, I've had lots of conversations with people who have been surprised or said, God, that smelt very familiar to me.
Going back to the little foxes.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you made comments on toxic masculinity before. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the two brothers, you know, Ben and Oscar. And they would be, I think many people might characterise that as toxic masculinity on display. But you're not crazy about the phrase. Do you want to tell me why?
I think masculinity is a describing noun. It would be a bit like saying, you know, oh, wimpy, pathetic femininity. And therefore, what do we say? All femininity is that. All masculinity is toxic. I have a son.
Yes.
And so I think masculinity can be a beautiful, glorious thing. So I don't want anything sticky added to it. There's toxic behaviour inside certain versions of masculinity. Absolutely. I've been in the room with it a million times. But I just think we have to be so careful because we're trying to raise a generation of male citizens who are good to each other and good to us. And, you know, I think we just have to be wary of them carrying the burden of other people's nastiness. And I see it and I hear it in them. And, you know, we forget. We just forget how plastic young people are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important that we just, I just think there's a sort of disregard around the mental health and mental well-being of young people. You know, everybody's very keen to hang on to whatever they need from the internet or whatever they need from social media whilst not thinking about young people and what the effects it's having on them. That's just one example. So I just feel like rhetoric around young people, their little aerials are always up and listening. So I think it's having a boy has really opened my eyes to all of that.
Yes, indeed. And I think there's these conversations exactly. And we've had full hours of call-ins as well.
I've listened to them.
Yeah, about, you know, about being a young boy in the environment that it is now. And how that is or what they need.
Yeah, and how there are people ready to jump in and say, all those people calling you names. You know, it's not helpful, I don't think.
So I will think about that when I hear the term toxic masculinity again. I'm coming back to family. You mentioned your son there. I also want to mention your brother. This is your brother, Eddie, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. I can't imagine what that was like. Particularly getting back into that family dynamic. How is he doing? How are you doing?
Well, you know, it's the journey. We're at a point now where he's going to need much more care.
Mm-hmm.
So we're applying for that. So we're going through that difficult process. And my heart goes out to anybody who's going through just the admin and the logistics of all of that. And yeah, I'd say he's been living with it for about 14 years. And he's only a couple of years older than me, so that tells you how young he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his diagnosis about 8 or 9 years ago. It's very, very difficult because you are watching somebody slowly vanish before your eyes. But the love doesn't vanish. And I'd say that is one of the gifts of all of it, is that the love is so present in the room. There's an unspoken version of your relationship that exists in another, it's almost like in a completely other element. It's so beautiful, you know. So he doesn't know who I am, but he knows that I love him, which is a very interesting. But I know the effect it has on a family.
Anne-Marie Duff talking to Nuala. And Little Foxes runs at the Young Vic until the 8th of February. And if you've been affected by anything you've heard in this interview, you can find help and resource links on the BBC Action Line website. Now, to a freelance journalist who says she's thinking of leaving the industry because of the apparent decline of black female journalists in our media. A report by the National Council for the Training of Journalists from September this year found that 91% of UK journalists come from white ethnic groups. This has increased by 3% since last year. It's also found that there's been a 12% drop in the number of female journalists in the UK since 2020. Amid large numbers of job cuts within the sector, what can be done to help keep black and ethnic minority female journalists in the profession? Well, Nuala was joined by the award-winning writer and journalist Afua Hirsch and Habiba Katcha, a freelance journalist who's considering an alternative career. Nuala began by asking Habiba why she's thinking about leaving the profession.
I wrote this piece a few months ago, and I think it was less about me wanting to leave the profession and more so me feeling like I was forced to leave the profession, and more so just thinking about the conversations that I was having with my Black female peers within the profession. So I was working at a publication for 2 years. I really enjoyed it. And then I just felt burnt out and I was freelancing. But I was finding that as I was freelancing, I wasn't getting as much jobs as I was before in previous years, just because I feel like the journalism industry right now is really tough. On top of that, I'm someone who speaks about race a lot in my writing. And I find that unless there's been a worldwide event or it's Black History Month, I don't get commissioned to write about race. So it just feels like there aren't many opportunities for me as someone who prioritizes Black storytelling.
And do you see that as the industry as a whole, just looking at some of the figures here, 2,500 media jobs lost in journalism across the UK and the US this year. This is according to Press Gazette, 8,000 last year. I'm wondering, do you see it particularly for an issue for Black female journalists, or is it just this is journalism right now?
I think it's an issue for journalism right now, but I feel like it's a more of an issue for Black journalists, because a lot of us firstly don't come from homes. We come from working class backgrounds. So if you come from a background where you can't freelance, it's really hard to get a job. You just can't afford to be in this industry. So I do feel like, yes, most journalists right now are really struggling, but I do think it is worse for Black journalists.
Interesting. What impact do you think the departure of people like yourself or some of your colleagues that you talk about that are Black female journalists, what impact might that have on journalism?
I think it is a lack of nuance for stories, not just Black stories, but stories in general, because I think when in the media in general, we still don't see a lot of Black faces and Black stories in storytelling. So I think it's a real loss if we don't have Black people, Black women in journalism, because there's going to be a lack of nuance when it comes to storytelling.
Let me bring Afua. You're hearing a little bit there from Habiba. Was there ever a heyday for Black female journalists, do you think?
Not in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I just want to say I really relate to everything Habib is saying. And, you know, it is sobering that I first became a journalist in about 1995. So this is almost 30 years later. And I feel word for word what Habib is saying are the kind of things that my peers were saying when I first entered the profession then. It is depressingly familiar. And, you know, as I've gone through my career in journalism, I've realized that this isn't a problem for us. You know, I think there's this tendency to think that we feel bad, we're missing out on careers in journalism, which we are. But, there's also a really important point that newsrooms are not doing their job properly. They can't actually do the work they exist to do of telling stories, of reporting the news, of achieving nuance and truth if they are not representing the communities they report on. And, you know, this is a different landscape now from when I entered the profession. There are ways in which people are taking control of their own storytelling if they can't find the work in newsrooms. Or, and I think, you know, Habiba's story speaks to this as well, it's not just that Black journalists aren't finding opportunities, which they're not at the same rate as their white counterparts, but also they're finding it's a hostile space. It's not one in which they can have autonomy over their careers. They can tell stories about Black people if they want to. They can also tell stories about other communities, other ideas, if they want to, that they can explore and grow. They get put into boxes. They get treated in a way that's different from other journalists. And it honestly can be very draining. So I think that one of the problems the media profession is going to have is that Black journalists are going to vote with their feet and go where opportunities are. They're going into other industries like scripted work. They're writing books. They're podcasting. They are using subscription-only platforms to tell the stories they want to tell. And as a result, we're losing that crucial voice in the mainstream media. And that's only diminishing trust, in my opinion, because I think a lot of people are becoming skeptical that the mainstream media doesn't really understand the nuances that are happening in our increasingly polarized society. So it really is a loss for the media. But I say that also not saying that it's fine for Black journalists because we can all just go on Substack. You know, that's not the reality. It is really, really hard out there. And I teach journalism now. So mm-hmm. I have a generation of students who I'm also really nurturing and encouraging and really believe in their voice, but also have to equip them for a world in which they are not going to find the doors open to them in the way that they should.
Let me throw it back to you, Habiba. There's a number of issues there that Afua was bringing up. First, you know, taking control of your own storytelling in some of the ways that Afua spoke about, but obviously that voice would be detracted from mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're thinking about, talking about?
Well, I think when it comes to newsrooms and storytelling, I think it really just depends on who's your editor. Mm-hmm. I think I was quite fortunate in the sense that I had an editor who very much on from the early set knew that I wanted to write about black stories. However, she always said, if you don't want to write about black stories, that's fine as well. But what happens is there are a lot of black journalists who are pigeonholed into being the black writer that writes about race when they don't want to do that. So I think it really just depends on who your editor is and things like that. But I do find now that there is a surge of black people who want to get into journalism or black journalists who are now having to, like Afua said, create their own Substack, of which I've started, go on TikTok, create podcasts and stuff like that. Because, again, as someone who writes about race and is a freelancer, you often find that when you are getting commissioned, because you're writing for, if you are writing for a big publication that has a white audience, you often find that you are having to explain specific concepts to white people. And that's something that you don't have to do when you're working for like a black publication.
Interesting. Because Afua, I know you've been put in that position of explaining at other times with various instances on some of the stuff I was reading and talking about that being very draining and at times exactly what you don't want to be doing if you were on air, for example, in some incident that had been racist in one particular instance. I suppose.
Can I just say something quickly? Because, you know, this conversation is a great example. I am enjoying this conversation because I feel like it's generally trying to get to the root of what's happening in journalism. But, you know, 5 years ago when I was doing that kind of journalism, I would have been put on with somebody who was saying, if black people aren't getting jobs in journalism, it's their own fault. Oh, it's because they're not good enough. And, you know, diversity is tokenism. And if they're not good enough to be journalists, what's the problem anyway? And then my role in this conversation would have been to explain why we exist. We have a different perspective. And if we're not represented, something's gone wrong. That's unfair. And you can imagine how exhausting that is to constantly have to persuade people that you have humanity, that you have a lived experience, and that you deserve to exist and do the work you're good at. And so in a way, this conversation for me is also evidence of the evolution we've experienced, that now I think someone like me and Habiba can have a conversation where we agree that something's gone wrong and you're interested and curious in what that is. But for most of my career, the only platform I would have been given would to be the black person up against the person who denies my blackness and my humanity, having to explain that I deserve a voice. So that, and that is still the experience essentially of so many black journalists, that, that the point of them, as far as their news organizations is concerned, is to justify their existence and to translate it for people who have no understanding or no education or many times no real interest in why that is.
Afua Hirsch and Habiba Katcha with Nuala there. Still to come on the programme, comedian Sophie Duca on her new stand-up tour. And remember that you can enjoy Woman's Hour any hour of the day if you can't join us live at 10 a.m. during the week. Just subscribe to the daily podcast. It's free via BBC Sounds. Now, Daisy Edgar-Jones will be a familiar name to most of you by now. She and her co-star Paul Mescal rocketed into the public gaze in the television adaptation of Sally Rooney's much-loved novel Normal People, the BBC lockdown hit, which had an astonishing 62.7 million views. The two of them gave performances that captured many people's hearts and imaginations. Since then, she's appeared in a number of well-known films, including Where the Crawdads Sing and more recently Twisters. And now she's back at the Almeida Theatre in London, playing Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams' play set during a birthday party for a Mississippi plantation owner. She joined me in the studio on Friday, and I began by asking her about her character, Maggie.
So Maggie is one of the most incredible characters I think I've ever read on the page. She is married to Brick Pollitt, who is the son of Big Daddy, whose party you mentioned. And yeah, this kind of play for Maggie, she is this sort of ferocious, desperate, outspoken woman who's trying to survive in this relationship that is kind of failing. And it's, yeah, it's kind of a very powerful, powerful character.
I want to say congratulations because I came to see you on Monday night and it's a very powerful performance. Thank you. The whole cast, all of you. It's electric. What's she like to play?
Do you know what? I'm she's quite an interesting character to inhabit every night because she's sort of the most outspoken, ferocious, angry person I've occupied. I often play characters that are quite introspective and vulnerable, and Maggie has all of that. But at the point that we meet her, she is this. She says it multiple times. I feel like a cat on a hot tin roof.
What does she mean by that?
She's sort of been pushed to the end of her tether, really. She's been living with this man who barely speaks to her because he's sort of punishing her for something that has happened the year before. And so she is this kind of bag of nerves that is trying to just be heard and to be listened to. And she's all survival. And Tennessee talks about the kind of play and particularly the conversation between Maggie and Brick as a feverish debate between the outcrying heart and the dying heart. Mm. And Maggie is outcrying and Brick sort of at that point, he's sort of drinking himself into oblivion. And so, yeah, I need to sort of wind down after each night.
I bet you too. And big theme, love, unfulfilled love. Mm. Lost, it's a powerful thing because it's not just about Maggie's love that's thwarted by Brick, it's about Skip's love for Brick, yeah. Brick's love for Skip.
Yeah, and this version is quite interesting because we have Skipper on stage. We have a sort of the ghost of Skipper actually present in the room, which I think really adds a lot of depth to Brick's journey. Because again, Brick, it could be a character you could struggle to like because he's ignoring this woman who's trying to be heard, but actually he's deeply sad. He's going through grief. He is going through identity and figuring out who he is. And, you know, and so, yeah, you sort of, you root for everybody, but you also, it's hard to relate to a lot of them. They've got so much complexity and darkness and realness about them, which is why Tennessee's so amazing.
Yeah, and it's a very satisfying theatrical experience, yeah, when you're in the audience. Another character is the piano that's on stage, mm, that Skipper is playing brilliantly, and the music's very tense. And you have to choreograph on that piano. Yeah. I did think you were very good. Was it nerve-wracking getting up there, having to do all the kind of...
Well, yes. I mean, I broke my toe.
You broke your toe
on day two of rehearsals, which was hilarious. Now I can laugh about it. At the time, less so. We were playing a warm-up ball game, I think we started at 10 a.m. and at 10:05 I was on the way to Amy with a toe that was not the right shape. And I was like, it's interesting because Brick in the play is wearing a cast with a crutch. And I was like, are Brick and Maggie both going to be hobbling around the stage?
They're painful and there's nothing you can do about a broken
toe. Yes, I couldn't walk on it. So we found a lot of the physicality sort of in discussion. And, you know, I was still able to do parts of it, but I think what's so amazing about Rebecca Frecknell, who's our director, I mean, she's incredible. And she's sort of done so many of these Tennessees. This is her third. She did Streetcar, she did Summer and Smoke. And, you know, what she does really well is she breaks it out of the traditional space. You know, our set is very this stark sort of tin room. It's like you really see the characters on this tin roof, really, in a way. And it makes you, as an audience, experience their psychological journey more than perhaps the reality of it. And so, yes, we have these moments where I sort of, Maggie becomes this cat-like figure, this sort of, this kind of tactical woman who's trying to work out her next play. And so having that kind of space of the piano, and she has this great line where she goes, "Who are you?" And she says, "I'm Maggie the cat." And and being able to get on the piano and
you arch your back.
Yes,
and it's magnificent.
Sort of cat-like.
You mentioned Streetcar Named Desire, that stars Paul Mescal. Did you get on the phone to him and say, "This has come my way"?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I saw that as well. Also extraordinary.
Phenomenal. And Paul, I was hanging out with Paul a lot while he was rehearsing, and I remember him saying, "Rebecca, that our director is one of the most incredible directors he'd ever worked with." So I'd been dying to work with her, and actually I was with Paul when I got the call for the job. I got a call on my birthday saying, "Would you like to play Maggie?"
Where were you?
I was in Ireland. I was in Cork for the film festival there, and it was really special because I'd been wanting to go back to the Almeida. It was the last play I did was there just before COVID, just before Normal People came out. And so feels really full circle to be here again 5 years later, taking on a role like Maggie with a director like Rebecca in that space. I feel so, yeah, it's really magical. So
it is magical, and it is wonderful to watch your ascent as well, both of you, but you know, to have you here and to see that you're on stage taking on this role. We've done a Christmas Day special program all about comfort and comfort zone and people stepping out of their comfort zone. How was it for you? How do you kind of prepare yourself? I mean, so much of your life is public now. You have millions of followers on social media. You've walked the red carpet, Met Gala, you know, awards, all the rest of it. Like, how do you deal with that? Of the fame.
Yeah, I think it's funny because stepping out on that stage again when I was doing my first warm up, I really was brought back to 5 years ago when I did a play called Albion at the Almeida, and it was just before lockdown, just before my life really changed, and everyone's did during COVID, but mine changed in the way that, you know,
more than others
became well known. And so I was really like, gosh, what a funny thing. People will come to this play with a different expectation of me, and there is a lot more pressure, and, you know, how have I changed and have I? And honestly, I stood there going, I haven't changed. I'm still, you know, I'm still who I am when I was on this stage 5 years ago. I'm just, you know, a bit older, a bit more weathered. But
hardly.
I think the thing that I love about theatre and love about what I do is it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to step out on that stage and give your performance. And I think that exchange between audience and actor is so beautiful, because that performance can only live and breathe in that one moment, and then it's done, you know.
Yeah, and you're very lucky if you get to experience it. You haven't changed, but the world around you has changed, Daisy. You know, you're hanging out with all the kind of, you know, Paul Mescal, the Andrew Garfields of the world. You're like Hollywood A-list. And when you could try and do something as simple as go to Glastonbury.
Oh, my goodness.
How was that? We were there. Woman's Hour's
there. Were you there?
Yes, oh, Woman's Hour's been 2 years on the road. You know, and next year, if you're there, come and chat to us.
I would love that.
But how was that experience?
The best. It's the best. I mean, I love music festivals.
How do you deal with the fame, though?
Yeah, I mean, it is funny. Whenever me and Paul go out anywhere together, which is just, you know, we're best friends, and I've known Paul. We knew each other before Normal People. We met on Normal People when we were just, you know, no one knew who we were, and so it is still so strange for us when we walk down Glastonbury and everyone's like, oh my gosh. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, if you know, because Paul's so grounded and normal, and all my friends are, and Andrew is too, you know, you're able to kind of just let it wash over you and enjoy the parts of it that are fun and try and ignore the bits that are sort of surreal, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, probably really important that you've got a crew.
Yeah, a good crew, a good gang.
Daisy Edgar-Jones there. And Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is on at the Almeida Theatre in London until the 1st of February. Now, Noel Stretfield's classic children's book, Ballet Shoes, was written in 1936 and, remarkably for a best-selling novel set in the world of theatre and ballet, has never been staged until now. The National Theatre's production of Ballet Shoes tells the story of the three fossil sisters, Pauline, Petrova and Posy, who were given their names because they were all discovered as babies on the travels of adventurer Great Uncle Matthew, and then abandoned to his great-niece Sylvia, or Garni, played by Pearl Mackie. Let's hear a bit. Well, I was joined by Pearl Mackie and the director, Katie Rudd, and I started by asking Katie why she chose to adapt Ballet Shoes.
I read Ballet Shoes as a child, and it was a really important book to me. I loved it. I loved the characters, the three sisters, and I was sort of inspired about this group of girls who were growing up in a house of dinosaur bones and fossils. I'm sort of, you know, as a child reading that, just ignited my imagination, and I just found it a really important book. And then years later, had sort of remembered it and was talking about it with the adapter Kendall Fever, and we realised it had never been staged. We couldn't believe it, and then started talking about adapting it, and here we are.
Here we are, yeah. I think we should just give people an overview, because, you know, I had never come across it. So just briefly, give us the story.
As you said, it's about the fossil sisters who are discovered as babies by their great uncle Matthew, who's a paleontologist, and just ends up finding these three babies and taking them home. And he then leaves them with his great niece Sylvia, who I play, and their Nana. And the house is full of fossils and bones, but it's also kind of falling down. So Garni and Nana are kind of desperately trying to hold it together. And they have to take in some lodgers as a kind of means to maintaining the house and giving them the family some financial support. And these lodgers kind of become mentors for the girls. One of them works at a dance school, and one of the girls, Posy, wants to be a ballerina. So they all end up going to this amazing dance school and discovering their passions. And one of the lodgers is owns a car, and one of the girls, Petrova, is really interested in mechanics and wants to, you know, sort of explores that with him. And there's just sort of a really lovely story about found family and about kind of, I don't know, I think it's really modern in the way that it's about girls like chasing their dreams and aspirations kind of against all odds, even though it's written in 1936.
Exactly, you know? Incredibly ahead of its time, I think. And yeah. Why had you come, did you know the story before?
I did, yeah, yeah. It was a book that my mum gave me when I was younger. She was, I mean, I was pretty over the moon when I got the job, but she was happier than I was.
Why do you think it's remained in print for so long?
I think it just has a universality to it, you know, timelessness to it. These girls, I mean, Noel Stretfield was encouraging these young girls to be ambitious and to make art and for themselves and nobody and to sort of create their own futures. That's a kind of groundbreaking idea in the
30s. Even now.
Yeah. And now.
Yeah. Exactly. It's I think that's what's so powerful about the story, isn't it? It's like, it's so modern in its outlook. You know, it's sort of feminist before feminism even existed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's like, it's such an important message to give to young girls and young people in general anyway, like even now. And like, I think that's the reason that it's still so universally loved.
It's modern, it's ahead of its time, but you have definitely modernised it, which we will talk about the bits and pieces that you've done. But there was a moment when it all switched for me. It's like, you kind of get the backstory, you get the build up, we learn who all the characters are, and then the girls and Garni, who are living in this, like, as you say, sort of genteel poverty in 1930s London, living on what is it, Cromwell Road, so living in the West. And they get together and they make a promise and a mission statement to each other, and they say, we try and put our names in the history books because it's our very own and nobody can say it's because of our grandfathers. Mm. They're not taking their father's or their grandfather's name. Quite a mission statement.
It's incredible. You know, it's so powerful for girls or anyone, actually, to go, let's do it for ourselves, sisterhood. Yeah. And these girls are adopted. They're not related, but they are family.
Mm.
And they're creating a future together. And that is an incredibly powerful message for us today.
Yeah. And let's talk about your character. You play Garni.
I do.
She's essentially a young parent. Of some very challenging teenagers.
Yeah.
I mean, she was 12 when the first baby's handed over to her.
You know, I mean, that's pretty young.
How did you approach the character?
Well, I think for me, I found it so interesting the way that she became a mother kind of without her choosing. But I mean, she obviously loves the girls so desperately, but she didn't really have much of a childhood. You know, sort of having to be a mother to, you know, three children by the age of 16 is
quite full on.
Yeah, it's pretty full on. Yeah, it's growing up quite fast. And I think the thing that really drew me to her was that she really desperately wants to protect the girls and wants them to have this childhood that she never had access to. Mm. And, you know, I mean, maybe all the decisions that she makes aren't necessarily the right ones. And I think there's kind of a beautiful rite of passage for her by the end of the story, learning that, you know, she has done quite a good job, but the girls do want to help and that they are people within their own right and they are older than she was when she first sort of started taking responsibility for them. And I think her kind of letting them into the family struggles and letting them kind of help and take care of each other is a really big moment, but is something that's beautiful and I think something that probably most parents can relate to.
Mm. Yeah, what you do magnificently, Katie, and through the writing and through the direction, is that every single character is given such depth and such backstory. You know, it's a theatre production, you're there to have a great time, but somehow we are so invested in every character. And with you, I was desperate for you to have a childhood. I thought,
yeah,
she just didn't have one. She turned up as an orphan, to this great uncle who disappeared. Great line, by the way. He's only able to do it because he has women to be able to support
his. I mean, totally, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that is the only reason he's able to go off on this adventure. I don't know if that's acknowledged in the book.
It is in the book, yeah. Yeah, this is the house of these stoical, strong women, something I really identified with.
Go on, in what way?
We're just having these matriarchs who bring up these children and are inspiring and doing what they can, the best they can for these young people, and that's definitely something I can relate to, and was really important that we held on to that, and as you say, that all these characters coming to this house were fleshed out and had in immense pain. They're sort of all people thrown together who find family together, and that is a really beautiful idea and important for young people to see, I think.
Yes, you're right. There is immense pain as an undercurrent, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the found family element is something that I personally related to as well. I mean, I think, like, you know, friendship is such an amazing thing. And I mean, my friends are my family. And I think it's such an important thing for young people to look at family, not in just a traditional setup, because, you know, especially for me as a queer woman as well, you know, there's so many queer people out there who aren't able to connect with their family due to, for many reasons, but also, you know, there's sometimes you just don't have that much in common with your family, and you find your people, and that finding that acceptance and finding that love in places that you didn't know it would exist is such a magical thing, and I think it's so hopeful.
Yeah, definitely. It's the perfect message around Christmas time as well, when, you know, even though it's a time of great joy and festivities, it also can be a very lonely time if you don't have the support of your family around you. Some of the themes which are quite subtle in the novel are more explicit in your production. In the book, Mrs. Jakes has a female companion. Yes. In the play, she identifies as a lesbian. We also know that the girls were adopted from around the world, but in the novel, the characters are white. In the play, they're ethnically diverse. Why did you make those decisions?
It just felt like it was important to be able to excavate the fact that Jakes was a lesbian and say that loudly and proudly on the Olivier stage. Felt like a really important thing to do. And it also gave her more of a reason to be in that house and to need that family. It explained to the audience, you know, it's just subtle in the book. It is there, but it's subtle, but we can say it, so why not?
Katie Rudd and Pearl Mackie there. And Ballet Shoes will run at the National Theatre until the 22nd of February. How would you describe my vibe? That's what our next guest, comedian Sophie Duker, asked her friends one day, but she didn't get the answers she was looking for. It turns out they thought she was niche, intense, and with daddy issues. Well, Sophie has written a new show called But Daddy, I Love Her, to explore why and to argue that we should all choose the lies we tell ourselves over the cold, bleak reality. Sophie joined Nuala in the studio, and just to remind you where you've heard her before, she's won a series of Taskmaster, appeared on Live at the Apollo, and hosted the official companion podcasts to the hit shows I May Destroy You and Everything I Know About Love for BBC Sounds. Nuala started by asking Sophie about those vibes her friends came back with.
Just insults, really. Just quite humbling things. Niche was what I got. Yeah, I always thought I was a classical mainstream beauty, but it turns out I'm very much avant-garde. What else?
I can help you. Yeah. Intense.
Intense, yeah. Yeah, I mean, coffee is intense. That's good.
And I think the corker.
I've completely...
Daddy issues.
Oh, daddy issues, yes.
You have a new show.
I have a new show. It's called But Daddy, I Love Her.
And so you're exploring some of the mismatched feedback?
Yes. So there is a big sequence in my new show when I'm very like trying to find out what my vibe is, what I give off as a human, ask my friends at a house party what my vibe is, and it's none of it is flattering. But the show itself is about delusion. It's about being Delulu and about my own daddy issues, both biological daddy issues and sugar daddy issues.
So the Delulu.
Yes.
Now it's kind of younger demographic is using that instead of deluded.
Yeah, instead of deluded, instead of delusional. So delusional is kind of like tawdry, but Delulu is, I say in the show, it's like delusional but camp, right? It's like fun, it's fancy, it's like romanticising your life.
Can you do that with daddy issues?
I think so. Like I think you can sort of put a spin, like a little rose-tinted sunglasses on the world and be like, instead of being like, oh, that man is, you know, giving me a pervy smile. You could be like, he's just reaching out, looking for a friend. I will cross the street, but I'll appreciate the sentiment.
So you have these competing narratives going on. First, how did you feel when your friends gave you the answer?
Oh, I think it's interesting to see yourself the way that other people see you. Like, my friends have said very, very many damaging things to me over the years. They said that I had a really old soul. They were talking about their souls and they were like, I have a childlike soul. I have a teenage soul.
I thought old soul was a compliment.
They said I had the soul of like a crotchety old lady, which doesn't feel like I was meant to be born in the 60s. I think it means I give Nana energy. Or just sometimes spiteful, you know, like maleficent vibes.
Now, and these are your friends, right?
Yeah, people, yeah. That is the label that they originally had. Now I'm not so... I think your friends are the best people to give you straight up stuff. Like, they won't sugarcoat it. They'll be like, yeah, this doesn't really suit you, or like, you're not the kind of person that can sit through that, or, you know, they kind of really cut to the core.
And was there consensus among your friends?
I would say most of my friends would say that I'm intense, which I think I'm a chilled out girl. You know, I eat food off the floor, sure. But I think that there's a certain eldest daughter energy that I bring to the table.
Oh, eldest daughter. There's another talking point we could have. Can we get back to the daddy issues for
yes,
a moment?
Yes, of course. Of course. All roads lead
you
to daddy issues.
You talk about going to therapy with your father, who was absent a lot during your childhood. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
I don't know if I would recommend it. It is another very if you're scared about asking your friends about your vibe, going to therapy with your dad is a whole roller coaster.
And he was up for it?
He was up for it, yeah. He's I think there comes a time, like when you are an adult and your parents are also adults, when you're like, huh, you're a full person, you've got flaws. I gotta kind of reevaluate my opinion of you. So I think it was a really cool, slightly delulu, nuts thing to do with my dad, but ultimately yeah.
A lot of material. But did it help the relationship?
I think it has helped the relationship. Yeah. I think that it kind of made me more hopeful about the relationship. I think if you kind of are set in your, like if you have like a parent where you're always nagging each other, or a parent where it's kind of established that you're not super close, you kind of believe that narrative. And I think like going to therapy, kind of having a third party or looking at your relationship in a different way, it was like, what if we called each other? What if we had a chat? What if we did this? And you kind of, as an adult, it's so hard to reinvent ways to be with your parents, but you kind of have to.
Sophie Duca there, and Sophie is touring across the UK and Europe in 2025. Well, that's it from me. On Monday's programme, Krupa will be joined by Strictly professional dancer Amy Dowden. Last year, Amy was diagnosed with breast cancer. She returned to the show, but then had to pull out due to injury. She joins Krupa to talk about getting back into dance after cancer treatment and with her new tour, Reborn. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.